Now, this is a discourse which the Rebbe said in 1965 on Purim, and it goes on the words Balaila, who on that night the sleep of the king was disturbed, and there were two discourses that year for Purim. Rabbi Lu, could you maybe comment on the fact that there were two discourses?
It happened on Purim several times that the Rebbe said two discourses, and about 10 times over the years that the Rebbe was there. But that was a very special year. It was the year, a few months before that, the Rebbe's mother had passed away, and the Rebbe was meeting much more frequently. Seems like in her memory, every Shabbos there was a Fabrengen. I don't recall anything like world situation of that time. I was there, actually. Unfortunately, I was there because the Rebbe gave a very big blessing a week later. Those who went out to army camps to read the Megillah, I didn't go to because I wanted to be by the Rebbe. And he spoke about the fact that in the city Shushan, able to rejoice, the Ratzim went out. The runners went out to give the message. So the Rebbe said, in other words, if somebody was one of a profound shlichus statement for two reasons. First of all, for the thing itself, the Rebbe said that by a person going out somewhere else brings a joy at a much higher level than if they had stayed and had a personal enjoyment. It's bringing it to a much greater purpose. And secondly, not just going out. It's going out at a time which is supercharged spiritually. You want to be right here, and you're going to a place which is an army base in America. Those are usually people who really don't have that much of a background, of a educational background. And if the rabbi, there's a rabbi Lushkin in Manhattan, and he came to the Rebbe. He was so glad that people had come to Manhattan from Crown Heights on Simchas Torah. It means they walked for about 3 hours, at least 2.5 hours to get there. And he thanked the Rebbe when he saw him. And the Rebbe said they had Mesiras Nefesh. Yeah, it's a real, real far walk in two directions. The Rebbe said the Mesiras Nefesh they had was not being at the Fabrengen here. So that's what that poem reminds me of, thinking about where you're needed, not the kicks that, even the spiritual kicks that you want to have.
Well, that in a way is a very good introduction to the discourse, because the discourse is about concealment and the positive power of concealment. So this discourse was actually edited by the Rebbe. Most of the discourses that we study on this forum were produced by the team, the Dvar Malchus, which comes out weekly, and every week it's like a magazine or a book, really, with many, many different Torah items in it. It's got the Sedra of the week with Rashi and with another commentator usually. It's got the Rambam, 3 chapters a day, 1 chapter a day, the Book of Commandments, talks by the Rebbe, and discourses by other Lubavitch Rebbeim, earlier Rebbeim by the Rebbe's father. There's a page of Talmud for each day. It's an amazing thing. It's all in Hebrew, but there is a version which comes out in English as well, a smaller version called Chayenu, which one is able to get. So normally the discourse, we normally study the discourse that they produce in this Dvar Malchus, because they've gone to a lot of work. They've added pointing so that it's easier to read in Hebrew. They've added a commentary and to spell out some of the more difficult things. And it's a very, very valuable resource. And it's all available on the web. And but sometimes they publish a discourse which the Rebbe had actually edited. Normally the discourse they print has not been edited by the Rebbe more times, you know, more generally. But this one has been edited by the Rebbe. So it's the first discourse the Rebbe said on Purim. And it goes on the verse, Balailahu. So we are now looking at Balailahu. Let's just see it in the text. So it's a famous passage in the Megillah where it says, it's the beginning of chapter 6, and it's in between the position of this part of the story is in between the two banquets that Esther made. Esther made a banquet inviting the king and Haman. And at that banquet, the king said to her, what would you like? I'll give you half my kingdom. She said, I would like you and Haman to come to the second banquet that I'm going to make tomorrow night. That night, so this is the night in between. And that night, as it says, Balailahu, on that night, Nadada Shnat HaMelech, the sleep of the king, it says his sleep deserted the king. We often translate it, the sleep of the king was disturbed. Vayoman, he said, Lahavi et Sefer Zichronot. He ordered the book of records, Divrei Hayamim, the chronicles, the annals, V'yu Nikraim Lifnei HaMelech, and they would be read before the king. So he couldn't sleep, so he wanted to hear something interesting. And that's where they found that Mordechai had saved the life of the king. And the king asked, well, was Mordechai rewarded for this? Because there were two people planning to kill the king, and Mordechai found out and he told the king. He told Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordechai. So it was written down that Mordechai had saved the king's life. So the king now wants to do something good to Mordechai. Now, just at this minute, Haman, who when he came back from the first banquet the previous night, was feeling very good and comfortable, and then he saw Mordechai who wouldn't bow to him, and he got all angry and he decided he's going to hang Mordechai, and he set up a gallows to hang him on, and he's now coming to the king in order to ask the king for permission to hang Mordechai. Now, as everyone knows, Haman comes into the king and the king says, what would you suggest should happen to the man that the king wants to honor? So Haman thought that this is about him, and he gave some kind of extravagant description of sitting on the king's horse and wearing the king's robe and the king's crown, and someone walking beside him saying, this is the man that the king wishes to honor. And the king said, wonderful, you go to Mordechai, the Jew, and do all that to him. Put him on the horse with my crown, and you walk alongside saying, this is the man that the king wants to honor. And then after that comes the second banquet, where Esther says, I'm very upset. There's someone who wants to destroy me and my people. And the king says, who can that be? And she says, it's this evil Haman who's here right this minute. And so within a few minutes, Haman's face is covered and he's going to be executed. And then his sons were executed. And then the Jews were given permission to fight against their enemies. So this moment of the night of the night, the sleep of the king being disturbed, is really the turning point in the whole story. Because up to here, it's been getting worse and worse, except that Esther has made one banquet, but it's like she didn't reveal anything at that banquet. It's just a mysterious thing. But now is the sleep of the king being disturbed, and now everything is going to change. So it's on this verse that the discourse begins. And we will try and play the mimer melody in order to partake of this beautiful discourse. Right, so this is the discourse of 1965, the first Purim discourse on Purim. Balayla hu nadadah shnat hamelech. On that night, the sleep of the king was disturbed. But tzalich lehavin, we have to understand. Omro balayla hu, the fact that it says on that night, delechaora, at first sight, Gam Kushaya Omer Balayla, if it just said at night the king's sleep was disturbed, how you yodim, we would know that it's talking about the night, that all these things happened beforehand, and then there's the nighttime, and then there's the next day. We would know it all. So why does it say that night? Given the idea that every detail, every word in the Torah, in any Torah text, is significant. And one can learn extra meaning from it. Now, this can be understood in terms of a discourse that the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, that means the sixth Rebbe, Rabbi Joseph Isaac, Yosef Yitzchak, he said a discourse in 1940, Purim 1940, which began in the same way. And he mentions that it says in the Jewish custom of how one lanes the Megillah, how one reads the Megillah, that at these words, the person who's reading has to raise his voice. When you hear the Megillah being read, you can look out for this. He's supposed to raise his voice. because this is really the main part of the miracle. This is where the whole thing, the whole story changes direction altogether. And he explains in his discourse, according to what it says in the Midrash, that when it says the sleep of the king was disturbed, it doesn't just mean Ahasuerus, the Persian king. Of course, it means him as well. But it also means Malko shel Olam, the king of the universe. Because when the Jewish people are in a situation of sleep, spiritual sleep, that means sleeping as far as Torah and mitzvot go, then, so to speak, it causes sleep to the king of the universe. And as it says in the Song of Songs, Ani Yeshena, the Jewish people say, I am asleep. Song of Songs is about a man and a woman. And the woman is the Jewish people. The man is the Holy One, blessed be. So the Jewish people say, I'm asleep. And the Zohar adds the word in exile. I'm asleep in exile.
And I'm through sorry, the Rebbe Tali, could you increase the size of the print a little bit?
I've made it as big as it'll go, I'm afraid.
Okay, thank you. Sorry to disturb.
Yeah, I mean, this is normally the bigger size. All right. Yeah. Yes, it's a bit bigger. Is that okay?
Thank you. That helps. Thank you.
All right. That through the sleep of the Jewish people, in a time of exile, the spiritual sleep, they cause a kind of sleep, so to speak, above. Of course, we can't talk about God sleeping. God is not a human being that he should sleep. But in terms of the revelation of God or the revealed activity of God in controlling the world and running it according to divine principles of holiness and of goodness, there can be a time of sleep when God's effect is seemingly absent. Like when a person is asleep, their consciousness is not controlling their hands and feet. The hands and feet are just inert, even though the person's fully alive. And there's everything happening inside their mind. They could be dreaming, but it doesn't affect the outer limbs. So the world as a whole can be in a state of chaos. That's what it means, the divine sleep. And that's what it means, Shabalaila hu nadada shnat ha-melech, that on that night the sleep of the king was disturbed. That is, that disturbance of the king's sleep, that's the main miracle. And the Laila, the night, is the time of exile. And that is a time of sleep above, a divine sleep, so to speak. And so that's what it means, that on that night of exile, the sleep of the king was disturbed, the sleep of the king of the universe, and that is really the main part of the miracle. We now go in to explore the idea of Laila Ahu. There's who, which means that, and Zeh, which means this. So according to this, we can explain the fact that it says Balaila hu, that night. And that indicates something which is more concealed, like that is something further away from you. You know, which book do you want? Do you want this book which is over here or that book which is over there? So that indicates something further away, something more hidden. Because in addition to the concealment of exile, which is night, so in general, then in the time of Ahasuerus, the concealment, we're now going on to the next page, which is page 16. We began off on page 15, we're now on page 16. It was an even greater concealment, a double concealment. As it says in the Talmud, where do we have a hint to the book of Esther, or to the whole story of Esther? in the Torah, in the five books of Moses, there's the idea that everything in Judaism and in life in some way should be hinted at in the five books of Moses. So there's a verse, V'anochi hasteh astir, God says, I will surely conceal my face on that time. It's a part of the Torah which is talking about a future exile. And God says, I will conceal my face. And the way it works in Hebrew is a kind of double term. Hasteh, conceal, and astir, I will surely, I will very much conceal. You see, it's the same word twice. There's the infinitive and then the future tense. And so the infinitive makes it more intensive. So that double concealment. Now the Baal Shem Tov explains, the founder of Hasidus, he explains that this double term, I will surely conceal, he says the concealment is hidden. And what does that mean? We're going to see in a second. And what the Rebbe is doing here, he's connecting that to Balayla Ahu, to that night. That the night of exile is in a way of that, which means it's hidden. And what does that mean in practical terms, in terms of people's consciousness? She'ein magishim she'agalut hu layla b'choshech. People don't realize that the exile is night and darkness. Samim choshech le'or. They think that the darkness is light. Now, that's one of the biggest problems. When people know that they're in a difficult situation, and because they're in a difficult situation, they try to work on themselves, they try to change the situation, they try to bring light into the situation. So then they know they're in darkness and they've got to have some light. But when people don't realize this, and they're just in a state of light, of darkness the whole time, and they think that that's normal, and they don't realize it's a problem, that is something much more problematic. And so in this situation, where the people are in a state of darkness, and they don't even realize that it's darkness, so then that is the situation of sleep of the Jewish people and the hiddenness of God. And the verse, the text, emphasizes that on that night, the sleep of the king was disturbed to emphasize the greatness of the miracle. That even though the sleep of the Jewish people was a total sleep, as it says elsewhere, the difference between sleep, shena, and tardema, slumber. People, in this way of analyzing it, the people who are just asleep, they have dreams, and they know that the dream is only a dream. They know the dream is false. Yes, have you ever had this? You're dreaming a dream, and you know it's a dream. You know it. This is only a dream. Whereas the ones who are slumbering, hanir damim, that's using another word for sleep, like a more intensive word, a deeper kind of sleep. They're in a dream and they think that the dream is reality. They don't realize it's a dream. Now, when a person is in this kind of state, that causes a similar sort of effect above, so to speak. So, in other words, a kind of an extra hiddenness of God, which people don't realize. Nonetheless, the sleep of the king was disturbed, the king of the universe, and not only the deep slumber, but even the lighter sleep was, it vanished, it disappeared, it went away, and God was revealed, and that's how we had the divine power rescuing the Jewish people in the most amazing way. Now then it continues in the discourse by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak that the fact that on that night the sleep of the king was disturbed, that that's the main miracle of Purim, that came about through the self-sacrifice of the Jewish people during the whole year. Now, let's stop sharing for a minute. Let's just come to try to understand this. And I mentioned it last week as well, that there is a unusual Kabbalistic and Chabad interpretation of the Purim story. Because one interpretation, one way of understanding the Purim story is Haman made his decree against the Jews and there was nothing they could do. But the other way understanding it, which is the way some Kabbalists like Rabbi Emanuel Hayriki and the Maharal of Prague and the stream of Lubavitch teachings, beginning with Rabbi Shneur Zalman, all the way down to the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, and our Rebbe, is no, there was something the Jews could do. The reason for Haman, well, let's start with Mordechai. The reason why Mordechai didn't bow to Haman is because Haman thought he was an idol. It was fashionable in the ancient world to think oneself to be an idol. Yes, Robert Graves wrote a book, Claudius the God, about one of the Roman emperors. That was what they thought they were, some of them. And so Haman believed he was an idol. And because of that, or, so the Talmud says this, or he wore an idol on his chest. So anyone bowing down to Haman would be bowing to an idol, either Haman himself or the idol on his chest. Mordechai is a pious Jew, an outstandingly pious Jew. He refuses to bow down to an idol. And that's provoked the whole situation. Now, Haman wants to kill the Jews. Now, the word Jews, you see, the Jew, we're familiar with the word Jew. It's the name for the Jewish people today. In the Tanakh, in the Bible, the word Jew has got a very specific meaning most of the time. It means someone from Judea. Now, you don't spell Judea, J-E-W. You spell it J-U-D-E-A. But a person from Judea, which means the southern kingdom of the land of Israel, and the northern kingdom actually was called Israel. So a person from the southern kingdom is a Judean. And in Hebrew, that is Yehudi, and that's the word that became Jew, the word for Jew. But when it introduces Mordechai in the text, it says he is a Yehudi, he's a Jew, and it then goes on to say he is a Benjaminite. So the Talmud asks the question, if he comes from the tribe of Benjamin, there are 12 tribes. So Mordechai comes from the tribe of Benjamin, why is he called a Yehudi, which means a Judean from the tribe of Judah? And it answers, anyone who denies idolatry is called a Jew, it's called Yehudi. Yehudi has a tremendously powerful connotation. I remember a very, going off the subject a little bit, but there was a manuscript that was found in Spain recently, in the last 100 years, I think it was. It was a manuscript found in Spain, and it was a manuscript from the time of the Inquisition. And it's a manuscript of a rabbi giving a talk to his congregation during the time of the Inquisition. And he's saying to them, what should they do if they are caught by the Inquisition, God forbid, and tortured? Because that's what the Inquisition is doing in the 15th century and the 16th century. In 1492, all the Jews were expelled from Spain, and the ones who were left were crypto-Jews, were Muranos, pretending to be Jews, and they were often caught by the Inquisition as well. But this talk was before 1492. He's telling his congregation, what should they do if the Inquisition catches them and tortures them? So he said, imagine the name of God in front of your eyes, in letters of fire. And if they say to you that if you give in and let themselves be baptized, then they will stop torturing him. He should say to them, I am a Jew, Yehudi ani, I am a Jew. Yehudi echye, I will live as a Jew. Yehudi amut, I will die as a Jew. Yehudi, 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 a Jew, a Jew, a Jew. That's how it is in the manuscript. And this was published by a historian. It's a very striking statement. And it's exactly in line with what the Talmud says in Tractate Megillah about Purim, is that the Jews are called Yehudim in the Megillah. It's the first time in the Bible that the Jews are called Yehudim, or that launching that word, the Jew, because they denied idolatry. Anyone who denies idolatry is called a Jew, just like in this manuscript from medieval Spain. And so therefore, the Jews are all the time being called Yehudim in the Megillah. So that indicates this Kabbalistic explanation of what the Megillah is really about, that the Jews could have said to Haman, we accept you as our idol, we'll bow down to you as our idol. And according to this explanation, he would have then left them alone. The only people he was concerned to destroy were the ones who denied him, which means the Jews who denied idolatry. And that was everyone. And so therefore, that's the intensity of the drama of what's taking place in the Megillah, which is not necessarily apparent on the surface, that the Jews they're ready to sacrifice their lives rather than serve an idol and become part of Haman's cult, if you like, that are the people who are worshiping Haman or the idol on his chest. So that's the special quality of this situation. Now, so that's the self-sacrifice of the Jewish people during that year, right? The whole decree with the beginning and finally the end, it took a year. And so there we have the Jews having self-sacrifice. Now the Rebbe asks, "Tzarich lahavin." Now we have to understand this. Hare bizman shel Yisrael osim rotzono shel makom. At a time when the Jewish people are obedient to God, they're doing what God wants us to do. In other words, they're keeping all the laws of the Torah and they're studying Torah. They're behaving the way Jews are supposed to behave in the full extent. Then, mitzad seidish tashalut, then in the realm of the downchaining of worlds, lo yanum v'lo yishan, then God is not sleeping in any way. The divine quality is vibrant and everything is beautiful and it's wonderful. So v'chevan sh'Yisrael amdu az, since the Jewish people then were in a mood of mesirut nefesh during the entire year. So one second, says the Rebbe, mahu hanes, what is the miracle? And even more to say the strength of the miracle, with the idea that the sleep of the king was disturbed. If they were in a mood of self-sacrifice for Judaism, wonderful, they're very exalted, and they're very religious, pious, spiritual, holy. And as a result, God is not asleep, doesn't seem to be asleep at all. God is with them. So that's the question which is asked over here. Now, the answer that we're going to get to, and Rabbi Lou, you may have a way of modifying this answer, but I don't know how much. It's quite a long discourse. We might not get to the very end. what the way the discourse explains this is that it's true they had self-sacrifice. They had self-sacrifice in the sense that they were going to stand up for being Jewish. But that doesn't mean that they had become pious Jews in the full sense of the word. There was a lot that was still missing. At the very deepest core, they're standing up for Judaism. But there are lots of other aspects of it where you could say that because of those other aspects, it's still a state of spiritual sleep. But the core, that core was alive. And that core was the prompting that Yehudi Ani, I am a Jew. And whatever happens, and I'm not going to betray my Jewishness. Over the years, meeting different individuals, I've seen this happen. Many years ago, this back in the 60s, there was a Jewish girl, and she had become very involved with Arabs, and she would and she got with an English boyfriend. They went to Egypt, and I met her and her boyfriend, and she was wearing a kind of a Moroccan Arab garment, a jalabi. So I said, the English boyfriend, the non-Jewish boy, so I said to them, so in Egypt, right, this is in the 60s, right? It's not a good place for a Jew, a visiting Jew, to be revealed as a Jew. Now there are tourists, Israeli tourists go to Cairo, but then it was different. So I said, and what would happen if someone suddenly said to you, are you Jewish? So the non-Jewish man immediately said, well, of course, we deny it. And so she said, I'm not so sure. So she's contemplating the possibility. There she is. She's got a non-Jewish boyfriend. She's very, very far from Jewish practice. And if in Egypt, at that dangerous time, particularly dangerous time, she would be asked, are you Jewish? She is not so sure she would deny it. Maybe she'd say yes, whatever the outcome might be. So that's the thing. The Jew was standing up for being Jewish, even though the outer aspects of the behavior of the Jew were not necessarily exactly following the code of law. Rav Alu, do you agree with that interpretation of the discourse?
Yes. And in fact, the commentaries on the Tanya speak about the uniqueness of the Jewish soul. And he says that people who were sinners, very far from Jewish practice, gave their lives to other generations. So the commentaries on the Tanya ask, why didn't he bring an example of a much more glorious of great tzaddikim, saints, and Kabbalists, and holy people? And it said that that is really what shows tremendous spiritual depth. It's something that's beyond the lifestyle of the person or different choices that they're just that they may have compromised on, but that's not the real. That's not what defines them. What defines them is the Jewishness.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Now I'm going to skip a little bit. So we're going to section Gimel. So now we're beginning a most beautiful. A scenic ride. I used to like the Big Dipper when I was a child. It's the scenic railway. and So now we're entering a kind of scenic railway in terms of revelation, concealments, a higher level of concealment, all about this idea of night and day and this and that. So fasten your seatbelts and let's see where we're going to go. Right. The Yuvan Zeh, now this will be understood by first considering what it says in the discourse in Torah or by Rabbi Shneur Zalman among the discourses on Purim. And then later in a discourse by the Mittler Rebbe, the second Lubavitcher Rebbe. That Yoim, day, is revelation. And night is concealment. And in each one of them, there are two dimensions. There's revelation and concealment. And that's why it sometimes says Yom HaZeh, this day, because this indicates revelation. So day is revelation, and this day is even more, it's a revealed revelation. But sometimes it says Yom HaHu, that day. And who, that indicates concealment. So although it's day, which is revelation, the revelation is in some way concealed. And similarly with night. Sometimes it says, Laila hazeh, this night. Now, night means concealment, but this is revelation. And sometimes it says, Laila hu, that night, which is a kind of double concealment. Moving on to the next page. And the basic difference, the explanation of this about day and night, that the whether it's day or at night or night, it can be more in a state of revelation or not. Now, the point being that the way in which the day and night are drawn down into the world, that is when we're speaking about Zeh, this. It's something revealed in the world, whether it's day or night, but it's revealed in the world. And then you can say this. But who? The concealment. That is when the day and the night, the way they are on a much higher level, before they have been revealed, and even higher, the way they are in their root. Now that's why in the redemption from Egypt, going out of Egypt on Pesach, it said, Be'etzem hayom hazeh, on this very day, the army of Hashem, that means the Jewish people, went out of the land of Egypt on this day. Similarly, when it's talking about the giving of the Torah, it says, Hayom HaZeh, this day the Lord your God commands you. But when it's talking about the future redemption, it says, Bayom Ahu, on that day.
Mm.
So you see, when it's a tangible thing that we can see, we are going out of exile and it's tangible, or we're getting the Torah and it's a real thing in front of us, it says this day. But when we're talking about the future, it says that day. Because the... Right, okay. So that's talking about day. The same thing about night. There's a darkness which is higher than light. A darkness which is higher than the essence of light. And the darkness, before it's revealed, is called that night. In other words, it's something beyond. And when it comes down below, it's called this night. In other words, that it's night, it's hiddenness, but it's revealed down below. Now, since this darkness of night is higher than the light, it is the root and the reason for every, and that through this, there is darkness, literal darkness, and every aspect of concealment, which comes from this exalted level of darkness beyond. And so Laila Hu, that night, is a tremendous darkness. It's much higher, it's much more concealed than the darkness which flows down into Laila Hazeh this night. When you say Laila Hazeh, it means the night is revealed. It's in a way of Zeh, it's this. And you can feel in a revealed way. And you can point to it. You can say it's night. Whereas Laila Hu, when it's that night, it means the night itself is concealed, so you don't even know that it's night. That's the point here. It's a darkness which is so deep that you don't know you're in the darkness. Like the exile, the person can think that they can think everything is fine, they're free, they have whatever they need. They don't realize they're in exile. Now, there's a beautiful interpolation here of another way of interpreting what it means this night and that night, day and night. It takes us into a very beautiful perspective on our relationship with the divine. You see, when we say the word day, it means that the person sees godliness, or at least has some kind of understanding of godliness. Now, that's a special quality, that a person can have this sense of an awareness of the divine. People who have lived through certain moments in their lives where the divine was present, and they can feel that sense of contact with the divine. Sometimes it's miracles in terms of a time of danger when they can feel that closeness to the divine. And so that awareness of God, or it might come, to be honest, from studying Hasidic teachings. Hasidic teachings open a certain door in our heart, in our minds, in our perception, that godliness becomes apparent. So the kind of teaching that we are discussing now is a teaching where every word is really about godliness, and the way that God is revealed or isn't revealed, is it revealed in this way or in that way. It's all, you know, it's like walking on the sand next to a tremendous ocean, an infinite ocean. And, you know, do you put your feet in the water? But you know the water's there. So behind this teaching is the infinite power of the divine in a very open way. All Torah teaching is an expression of the divine. But much of the time, you don't notice that. The Torah teaching is very interesting and intricate and complicated, and it's telling you all kinds of subtle ideas, the 39 kinds of work which are forbidden to do on Shabbat, and you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. On the other hand, there are various positive, beautiful things you should do on Shabbat. But it's like describing what's happening in our practical lives. Whereas when we're studying a teaching like this, it's all about contact with God in one way or the other. So the point is, if there is sight or grasping of godliness, then it's day. And if there isn't, but the person is a believing person, then it's called night. And when it says Laila Hazeh, this night, it's that the faith is very strong. In fact, it's so strong, it's almost like sight of God itself. That's why we say at the Pesach Seder, Halayla Hazeh, right? This night at the Pesach Seder, it's like an awareness of God. God isn't necessarily revealed, but there's such a strong sense of emunah, of faith in God. God took us out of Egypt. And here we are today, thousands of years later. It's incredible. You can feel the godliness in the air, even though it's a sense of faith. So we talk about Halayla Hazeh, this night. Ma nishtana Halayla Hazeh. Why is this night different to all other nights? So it's still night because we're still in exile. But the faith is very strong, and it's almost like seeing. So there's a beautiful passage here, which is what brings a person to this kind of sight? What brings a person to the sense of the awareness of the divine? Now, I mentioned before studying Hasidic teachings or studying any aspect of Torah. It's an interesting thing that the work of the Jewish people in Egypt, it was backbreaking work, it was terrible work, they were slaves. But there is some sense in which the effort that they were making, simply because they were Jews, because they were the children of Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and there they were slaves in Egypt, and they were doing this heavy work because they were the Jewish people, the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This itself transformed them. This itself brought them closer to the divine. Very striking image here that work in itself is something which can purify a person and enable them to have intimations of godliness. So that's the interpolation. Now we go back. We're now putting on our seatbelts again, going for another ride on the Big Dipper. When I was a child, we used to go and stay in Westcliff over Yom Tov, over Pesach and Sukkot. So on Chol HaMoed, we would go to the Kurzel, which was like a big fairground kind of thing. And there was a Big Dipper, and I would go on it so often, they gave me reduced charges. I just loved this whirling round and round. And I even found a place that you could get out of the car in the middle of the whole thing and just stand on the side. And anyway, so here it's another Big Dipper. And here we are connecting this discourse that we're learning now, which the previous Rebbe said in 1940, right? Our Rebbe is discussing a discourse the previous Rebbe said in 1940. We're now moving to another discourse the previous Rebbe taught in 1950, just before he passed away, about the radiance of the Ein Sof. This is the Bati Legani, I've come into my garden, very famous discourse in Chabad. The Rebbe discussed it many, many times every year around the 10th of Shvat. And here it's about the radiance of the infinite, which goes higher and higher without end and lower without any, without limit. Now, the whole idea that it goes lower and lower without limit, it's something which going lower and lower without limit is an expression of the revelation of the divine. It's an expression of the revelation of the divine, which spreads down, down, down. Going up, that is the idea of the concealment, the ascent in the radiance of the infinite, which goes higher and higher beyond concealment after concealment, right? So we got two movements. Going down, which means more revelation, going up, which means more hiddenness. So then comes a whole discussion of the way that this, these two directions of the light, they come from what's termed the tzimtzum. The tzimtzum is the moment that there was, as it's described in Kabbalistic books, particularly the Tree of Life by Rabbi Chaim Vital, the disciple of Rabbi Isaac Luria, that at the beginning there was infinite radiance of God, and then there was a kind of veiling of this radiance, and the result of the veiling is that there would be, in a sense, space to create the world. So there's a way of thinking of the radiance after this tzimtzum, this veiling, and the radiance before. And so what the Rebbe is showing here is that even in the radiance before that veiling, you've got these two directions. The direction which is going down, 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 ultimately, and it's going to lead to revelation. And the level above, which is complete concealment. And so so the discourse interconnects with that as well. So there's this idea of this concealment and revelation, and that links with our night and day and this night and that night, right? All these different dimensions of concealment and revelation. Now, if we consider this in terms of the service of the person, right? So we're now at the end of section Vav, which is on page 23, and we're discussing the service of the person. How do these different aspects relate to the individual? The service of the night, which is the darkness of exile, in fact, the darkness of this world, the way we see it now, is because of the concealment, the veiling, which is for the sake of revelation, means that the person has a yearning, a thirst to leave the darkness of the night, the darkness of exile. So one can be in exile with a thirst and a yearning to leave that exile. And that is the idea of the power, which is through the tzimtzum, the power of revelation. But then there's another situation where it's a service in the night, where the power of concealment is revealed. And that means the person contemplates the root of the darkness, the root of the night, and sees that the night, the exile itself, comes from the essence of the divine. It's not as if you have to go anywhere. Right? There's a situation of exile where you have to get out of exile. Maybe that's a way of explaining it. You have to get out of exile. So there's a thirst. Let's get out of exile. Let's get out of the darkness into the light. But there's another way of thinking of it. The darkness is the light. The deepest darkness is there because of the essence of the divine. And you suddenly realize that this exile is not exile. It's redemption. It's a very, very profound, very beautiful concept that the Rebbe is explaining here. And that's what it means, section Zion. that on that night the sleep of the king was disturbed. That is the king of the universe. Laila, who that night is what causes the sleep of the king to be disturbed, to remove the sleep. Because the root of that night below is actually Laila Hahu, that night above, which goes beyond the concealment of that day and beyond the concealment of this night. It's higher. It's that night. It's beyond. And at that point, beyond, it connects with the essence. And through the fact that the Jewish people were in a state of Mesirat Nefesh, of self-sacrifice, readiness for self-sacrifice throughout that year, and their self-sacrifice was because of the concealment. Through that came that quality of Laila Hu, that night, which is above, beyond the night, that night which is below. In other words, they reached this very exalted level. And that's really the connection between the way of understanding. What does it mean that night the king's sleep was disturbed? One way we can understand that is that the night, the fact that it's that night, that it's such a hidden thing, the godliness is so hidden, that's what it means the king was asleep. And so by saying it's that night, you're emphasizing, you know what, even though it's that night, nonetheless, the king's sleep was disturbed. What a miracle. But the other way is to understand that that night itself, that very darkness, the total darkness, is what removes the sleep of the king, because we're beyond the concept of sleep. You're reaching the root. And then it's by reaching that root, which is, so to speak, utter darkness, that's where there is no sleep either. The discourse then talks about a way in which, whether it's revelation or concealment, that the idea that they're not two opposites. It's as if they are the same thing. From the point of view of the essence, they're the same. And it's a matter of reaching that divine essence, where, whether it's revelation, whether it's concealment, it's the same. Now, to me, we'll come back to this in a moment. To me, what this relates to very strongly is the way in which the Rebbe was pushing very strongly the idea of Mashiach. Open your eyes and see the redemption. The idea that by being connected at this exalted level in the right way, one sees the redemption. One sees it, even in the darkness, even in the deepest darkness. And the Rebbe spoke about the way gola means exile, the word gola, gimel vav lamed he. And geula means redemption. And the only difference between the two is a letter aleph, gimel, Aleph, Vav, Lamed, He. So, and the Aleph is godliness. By recognizing the godliness in the exile, one discovers that the exile is not exile. So that's the way that I understand what this discourse means. Rabbi Lou, would you like to comment at all on this point?
It's a beautiful point, and you said it in a fascinating way. Nothing really to add, just to put it in a one-liner thing. See, in life, the ups and downs, day in, and you, You hear me?
Hear you now. Your voice coming and going.
Is it steady now?
Seemingly.
One second. I'll take off my AirPods. So I'm just saying that in life, one second, in life you have day and night. And by touching a deeper aspect of one's life, which transcends the day and the night. One realizes that the night is day, but it's not the day that you thought it is. And the day is not the day that you thought it is. The success story was not a real success, and the failure was not a failure, because there's something deeper which is higher than both, and therefore they are manifestations of a much deeper purpose and a deeper reality where they are part of one. There's a harmony and there's a unity and there's an alignment between all the different forces, and everything in life is part of that puzzle. But just the knowledge that it's something connecting to a much deeper source gives one the wherewithal to be able to reveal it.
Thank you. Yeah, that's lovely. Now then we have another concept, which is the idea of surrounding radiance and inward radiance, right? Now this is a very common thing when exploring Chabad Hasidic teachings. There is the inward radiance, which flows through the world, giving existence to everything, and a surrounding radiance, which surrounds everything. And so the idea that these two types of radiance, that's actually those two types of radiance are being connected. That the light which is beyond the downchaining of the worlds, which is the surrounding radiance, instead of just being surrounding, it's drawn down into an inward mode as well. Because the root of the difference between the surrounding and the inner radiance is revelation and concealment. The surrounding radiance is revelation, and the inner radiance, which comes through concealment, tzimtzum, veiling, is the idea of hiddenness. Through the revelation of the essence that took place, that through this, concealment and revelation were joined, as we were speaking about before. And there's also a connection of makif and pnimi, of the surrounding radiance and the inner radiance. And through this comes a salvation for the whole Jewish people. And in such a way that the fact that Haman made this gallows 50 cubits high, it means he was trying to exalt himself to receive from the 50th gate, which is above the downchaining of the worlds. He was trying to reach for a very exalted high level. However, through our special relationship with the divine, the surrounding radiance entered the inner radiance, the revelatory dimension entered the realm of hiddenness and concealment, and then came this great transformation that it became for the Jewish people. There was radiance and joy. Vayehudim haita ora v'simcha v'sason v'yikar. For the Jewish people, there was light and joy and rejoicing and honor. Kein tielam. So it should be for us. And with that, the discourse concludes. Thank you. I wish you a very, very happy Purim, and people who are able to join us tomorrow night at Nicole and David's. Hopefully you've told Nicole and or me, and I've passed it on to Nicole. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll meet together face to face in a face to face event. And hopefully, together with the redemption, the Geula and Mashiach, and a whole transformation of the whole world.
Amen.
Same time.